From Toronto, Canada, this is 1 MHz, the Apple II podcast. Yes, really. In this episode, you probably know how many bits are in a byte, but how many bytes are in a cake? And what do you get when you lock Steve Wozniak in a hotel room? Getting your 2GS on the internet just became easier, a vintage computer festival rolls into the Garden State, and in the game review, we'll find out if you're tass enough to help a talking dog save Gramps. All that and a bit of my own Apple II history coming up on 1 MHz for May 2006. Welcome to 1 MHz, 8-bit Apple news and 2-bit Apple reviews. I'm the host, Carrington Vanston. Thanks for listening. This is the inaugural episode, and over the next few shows, I'm hoping to refine the format. I'd be open to suggestions. I'm kind of making this up as I go along. For now, I'm going to divide the time between a recap of recent Apple II-related news and a review or two of some hardware or software that I've been playing with or using lately. I thought, though, for this first show, I would introduce myself and give you a bit of my own Apple II history. My association with 8-bit Apple systems goes back to the 2 Plus, which was my fourth computer. Prior to the 2 Plus, I had things like an Altair 8800, and I had a Kim. My parents were pretty good about indulging in their son's nerd-like whims, and I appreciated it, and still do. But the first few computers I had, I love them, but I use them primarily as a way to learn about computers and to work on improving and modifying whatever computer was in front of me at the time. But that changed with the Apple II Plus. That was the first computer that I really used to be productive in other ways, you know, outside of the computer. And of course, also for entertainment. But even the entertainment was different. On the Altair, for instance, I could bootstrap BASIC and make my own simple games or play with code that others had written. But with the 2 Plus, I started playing a lot of pre-compiled games and graphical games. Games that I played not to examine the code or even necessarily to learn from them, but just to enjoy playing them. You know, games strictly as entertainment. Which, I guess now that I say it, is a bit of a strange concept. You know, sort of strange to make the distinction, but I think those of you who use computers at the time, and there must be some of them, some of you listening to this podcast, you'll remember the dearth of early software. I mean, in the late 1970s, if I wanted to play a version of, say, Space Invaders, then I would have to write a version of Space Invaders and type it in again every time I restarted the computer. But with the Apple II, it was a dividing line between computers as entertainment and computers for entertainment, if that makes any sense. And, you know, it was as much of a dividing line for productivity, maybe even more so. The 2 Plus was the first computer that I used for word processing. It was the first one I used for spreadsheets, my first databases. I mean, so many productivity programs, I was introduced to them on the Apple II. You know, that Apple II Plus was the first computer that I used the way that most of us think of using computers today. Since then, my computers have gained more memory, more storage, larger screens, much, much faster clock cycles, and a couple of new things I can do with them, like podcasting, for instance. But the Intel Mac Mini on the left, which is recording this podcast right now, is fundamentally the same device, the same sort of device, as the Apple IIe sitting to my right. In fact, they're actually both hooked up right now to the same 20-inch LCD screen in front of me, a hookup that I'll probably go over in a later episode. I guess what I'm saying is, for me personally, the Apple II marked the beginning of what I think of as modern computing. And in the past few months, I've been playing with and working with 8-bit Apple systems again, and I've been surprised. I've been really pleasantly surprised at not just how enjoyable, but also how useful these computers still are. And I don't mean that they're good for their time, but for right now, for today. that's why I'm looking forward to, I guess, to use this podcast to document my own experiences with Apple II computing now. And even though this is technically a retro computing podcast, I don't want the focus to be on just reminiscence or nostalgia. I'm sure, you know, some of each of those is going to creep into every episode regardless, but I want the focus to be on the Apple II today. What's new and exciting with 8-bit Apple computers? How are they being used? You know, not just still being used, but used in ways that are new and to do new things. Things that I wouldn't even have thought of 20 years ago. It's the same for the reviews. I'd rather not make allowances or excuses for the state of software and hardware back then. You know, back as the cool kids say, in the day. I'm sure a lot of the things that I loved at the time will not have weathered the years well. Okay. But some things may surprise me. We'll see. But I honestly believe that Apple II computers are still relevant and still exciting. They're useful and they're fun. And now they have a podcast. And so that's me and the Apple II. And I think it's probably enough about me. There's a lot more interesting things happening in Apple II world than my little podcast. So let's get to some news. As I said, I'm sort of making up this format as I go for now. I think it'd be good to include highlights of some interesting new developments related to the Apple II. I don't think, though, that this podcast can be, or even should be, a primary source of news. For one thing, I think I'm going to make this a monthly show, so some of this news will no longer be so new. But I do want to highlight some of the most interesting and notable things happening with 8-bit Apples. For instance, 2006 is the 30th anniversary of Apple Computer, and to celebrate that fact, the people over at the Joy of Tech website decided to bake a cake. Now, not just any cake, a cake in the shape of the Apple I sitting in the Smithsonian Institute. Now, if you've ever seen an Apple I, and if you're interested at all in 8-bit Apples, you've probably seen a photo of this particular Apple I. The Apple I was a kit computer, and so users built their own cases. This particular case is probably the most famous of them all, I guess. It's the one with the upright wooden board at the back with Apple Computer routed out of it, or carved out of it, maybe burned out of it. It's the dark wooden one. And I'd always wondered who made that case, and happily, so did the Joy of Tech bakers. They asked Woz about it, and it turns out the case was built by Randy Wigington's father. Now, who's that? Well, according to Wikipedia, Randy was there when Woz first presented the Apple I at the Homebrew Computer Club, and then Randy went on to become Apple employee number 6. He later collaborated with Woz on things like the circuit design and ROM routines for the Apple II. In fact, you may have heard the story about how Woz and another fellow, guess who this other fellow was, quickly had to write the disk to rewrite track sector routines in a hotel room at the 1978 Consumer Electronics Show. Well, that other fellow was, of course, Randy, and he later created lots of Macintosh applications as well, including MacWrite. So this is quite the accomplished guy. And now, 30 years later, someone has baked a cake in the shape of his dad's handmade wooden computer case. It is a strange world, and a world of cake. On the Joy of Tech site, you can see how the cake turned out, and you can also get the recipe and instructions for baking your own, if you want to have your own 30-year celebration cake festivity thing. I'm living a baking-free life at the moment, so I doubt I'll be making the attempt. But the photos of the cake make it look delicious and remarkably accurate. They did a great job. I'll put a link over to the Joy of Tech's cake page in the 1 MHz podcast show notes, and those are at monsterfeet.com, MONSTERFEET. And that's the site that I use to host my podcasts, including this one. In less sugary news, Syndicom has released its new Apple 2GS Internet Starter Kit. That includes the latest version of Marinetti, which is the TCP/IP stack, and assorted internet-related software like GS Shrinkit, the MailCheck and Telnet NDAs, the Stolen Base NDA for handling MIME, the Arachnid web browser, which I think is still in a preview release, but it's functional, and a bunch of other software. It's only $5 US for the disk, which you can get directly from Syndicom. And to me, that seems like a pretty good deal and a very convenient thing if you don't already have this software and want to get your 2GS on the internet. And of course, why wouldn't you? Syndicom, I should point out, also has Telnet starter kits for both the 2C and the 2E, and both of those are available on either a 3.5-inch or a 5.25-inch disk, your choice, and they're just $2 each US. So if you want to pick up any of these kits, I'll have a link to the Syndicom site in the show notes as well. You know, speaking of Syndicom, as a bit of an aside, I've been considering becoming a member. If you're listening to this podcast and you have any opinions or thoughts about the value of that service for an Apple II user or some experience with Syndicom, recommendations for or against, then drop me a line. I'd really like to hear some opinions about it. Okay, let's see. What else? Oh, the Vintage Computer Festival East will be happening on Saturday, May 13th in the InfoAge Learning Center in Mall Township, New Jersey. It's the third annual event, and it'll run from 9:30 a.m. until 6 p.m. Parking's free, and admission is $10 a person, or $7 for kids 13 and under. And I haven't been to this show before, and it looks like I'm going to miss it again this year, unfortunately. And, you know, that really is too bad, because it looks like a great event with a good variety of things to see for retro computing enthusiasts. It's not necessarily, I think, always a lot of Apple-related material there, but if you're into this era of computing, you'll certainly find a lot of things that are interesting, and I think usually there's at least some Apple II stuff. I'm definitely going to try to make it out next year. I'll have a link to the Vintage Computer Festival site in the show notes so you can read about the vendors and the speakers and get directions to the show. Okay, now I think I will do the first software review of my new podcast. I hold in my hands a box of software, a game from 1986 by Activision. It's called, well, actually, let's quiz you. Let's see if you remember. This is what it sounds like on an Apple IIe. Recognize it? No? Well, maybe you'll have better luck with the 2GS version, which sounds like this. And that is the sound of Tass Times in Tonetown, which is billed as a bizarre adventure into an alternate reality. The box is mostly teal green and bright yellow, and on the back it's got bright pink. So, welcome to the 80s. It says, Tonetown, are you ultra-tone or a total tourist? Tonetown is a totally radical dimension. Totally radical. A totally radical dimension where the top tune is Tass by the Daglets, the top gear is Tropoware, and the ultra-touch haircut is a die cut by Chaz. What are you doing there? Simple. Your favorite old guy, Gramps, has disappeared from his warm, cozy home dimension. He's stuck in Tonetown, and it's up to you to figure out a way to get him out. That's tricky enough. But just to make things even more interesting, there's a character with green scales, dirty fur, and yellow fangs. His name is Franklin Snarl, and he's not half as nice as he looks. And if he gets you before you get Gramps, you won't look so great either. Along the way, you'll get lots of help from Enio the Legend, who used to be Gramps' dog Spot, and you'll get lots of clues from some ultra-tone friends, but the tough stuff is up to you. So what's the deal? Are you crass enough to go for it, think it over. Because once you get into Tonetown, the only way out is to go all the way in. When I returned to Apple II computing recently, one of the main reasons was so that I could replay a few games that I had remembered really loving when I played them the first time round. And there were also a few with which I had some unfinished business. Games that, not to put too fine a point on it, kicked young Carrington's butt when we first met. Task Times in Tonetown is one of those games. This is a graphical text adventure, which means it's sort of positioned halfway between the older text-only adventure games, like, say, an Infocom game, and the later Sierra games, where you move a character by clicking and you walk through the adventure game all graphically. This has elements of both. You can play it completely as a text adventure, typing stuff in, typing, you know, get key or kill dragon with the soggy noodle, that sort of stuff. You can even turn off the graphics, but part of the appeal of the game is, of course, that it does come with graphics. It has a display that shows you the room or the area you're in. It has some sound effects and some motion and animation that really, you know, add to certain rooms. It also has on screen a bunch of large icons that stand for the most commonly used verb. So you can, for instance, let's say you're in a room and you saw a key in front of you. You could type take key or get key. You could also click on the icon for take and then just click on the key, and it does effectively the same thing. Both of those add the key to your inventory. Now, maybe it's because I'm an old school text adventure sort of guy, but I found I played the game only by typing in the commands that I want to execute. I didn't use those icons at all, I think. The graphics to the game, though, do add a lot to the experience, and they go a long way to defining this very unique world of this game. A lot of the fun of the game is because of that. So I was very glad that it was a graphical game. It's just I could do without the icons. You can't win the game using just the icons either. So it's not the sort of game you can play with only those icons. Those are the most common verbs, but there's a few things you have to do, including at the very end of the game, that you cannot do with those icons. And I wonder if maybe people who play the game and get used to using those icons are more likely to get stuck later on, because you might not think that you could try something completely differently if you're not used to having to think of your own verbs as you go. Another thing that really adds to the world of the game are the supplemental materials. It is not up to the standards of, say, an Infocom game, but there are a couple of really fun things that do come in the box. One is a button. You get a button that says, I smell snarl meat. Not really going to be wearing that one outside. But more fun is the Tonetown Times. That's this newspaper here. It's a large fold-out newspaper that comes with the game. Now, this is really one of the anti-copying mechanisms, because to play this game, you need to have read this newspaper. It gives you a bunch of tips, and there's even some very simple things that you can't do, I think, if you haven't read the newspaper or don't have a walkthrough at hand. For instance, to have conversations with people in Tonetown, you have to address them by name, and the way you know their name is to have read about them in the Tonetown Times. So there's that. The newspaper itself is also very funny and very interesting and contains a lot of subtle clues that you can use during the game. Things that might not jump out at you as being important when you first read them, but then later in the game, something will strike your memory. You'll think, hey, didn't I read a classified ad about that? Or wasn't this mentioned in an article? So I found it a great little supplement. It added a lot to the game. One thing that the newspaper tells you is what's hip or what's, you know, TAS right now in the city. Because you have to blend in. If you don't blend in this city, you will be caught by Franklin Snarl and you will be eaten. That's how you die in this game. When I played the game originally on a 2GS back 20 years ago, I died quickly and repeatedly and finally, and then I just gave up. That's how the game beat me, and it beat me really early on. I found the way to jump over to the other dimension, I would take a couple of steps in any direction, I would be caught and I would die. Now, it's not really a spoiler because this is included in the newspaper. I knew that to not get caught, I had to be TAS. I had to get my hair all fluffed up with colors. I had to wear a jumpsuit. I had to wear hoops. I had to wear a mask. I knew that going into the game. Before I even booted the game, I knew that. But I couldn't get anywhere in the game without dying. I couldn't get to any place where I could acquire these things. It was very, very frustrating. So when I sat down to play it again now, I had the walkthrough at hand because the smart money is always on the guy with the walkthrough. I figured I would play the game. I would get to this very frustrating early part where I die repeatedly. And then I would take a glance at the walkthrough and see what the heck it was that I had missed all those years ago. So I load up the game. I play it. Very quickly, I jump over to the other dimension. I take a couple of steps in the most obvious direction. And I'm standing in front of a place that sells all the stuff I need. Now, what the heck's going on? I am positive that 20 years ago, that store did not exist in this game. But now, it was really easy to find. Really, really irksome that 20-year younger Carrington couldn't find this thing when all it is, you know, walk two steps straight forward and there's everything you need. Now, something else that seemed hard and is, I guess, is appropriate bringing up now because it relates to the fact that I played the game before. And it is a tiny bit of a spoiler, but it's something that happens very early in the game. And I think it's important to discuss because it's my key frustration with this otherwise amazing game. And again, this is a small spoiler, but it's very, very early in the game. So it's like the second room. It's no big deal. The text parser let me down a little bit in the way it would respond negatively. It wasn't clearly negative enough. Here's what I mean. When I played the game 20 years ago, I found a bunch of guitar picks in a fishbowl really early on in the game. And I knew I needed the guitar picks because of some clues in the newspaper. So I remembered from 20 years ago, finding the fishbowl, seeing the guitar picks in it, and taking the guitar picks. This time around, I'm in the same room, I see the fishbowl, and I type, look in fishbowl, and it says, you see nothing of interest in it, or something along those lines. Which is odd, because I have a very clear memory of these guitar picks and their location. I try, take the bowl, won't let me take the bowl. I try breaking the bowl, won't let me break the bowl. I look all around this house now, figuring, well, I'm wrong. The guitar picks I thought were in the fishbowl, they must be someplace else. Search the house completely, only because I know, with my previous experience, that there are guitar picks to be found. Finally, I go back to that same room again and just type, take picks, and it gives me the picks. So I know they're technically in the room, but I can't actually take them, you know, without cheating, because I haven't really found them. I'm searching like crazy. I'm looking at in this fishbowl. I'm looking under the fishbowl. I'm looking all over the place. Finally, I just say, look at the fishbowl. And it says, all you see is a clear fishbowl, empty, except for some guitar picks in it. Now, that's very frustrating, because if you type, look in fishbowl, it doesn't tell you there's any guitar picks. If you say, look at the fishbowl, it now admits there are guitar picks. And it's particularly frustrating because in the room just previous to this one, there's another sort of jar. And to get the thing in that jar, you must type, look in jar. And that's how you find that the thing you need to get into the room with the fishbowl. So it's established the mechanism here of dealing with containers, that you look in them. That sort of thing comes up more frequently than it should in this game. And it's the one great bothersome part of an otherwise fantastic game. And I can sort of understand this from a programming standpoint, that they wanted to create the fishbowl as a transparent object, so you could see its contents when you look at it, and the other jar is an opaque object, so you have to look inside it to see its contents. And that's fine, but the case should have been made that if you look in a transparent object, you can see its contents just as well as if you looked at it. So while I can understand this from a programming standpoint, it's frustrating from a playing standpoint. And I really don't want to harp anymore on the parser because the game itself is really original. It's very funny. It has a terrific ending. It has some really good and interesting puzzles. It's not overly difficult. On the 2GS, the graphics are quite good. On the 2E, they're more than passable. And I played it this time on the 2E, and I enjoyed it thoroughly all the way through. I heartily recommend this game. If you like adventure games and you haven't played Task Times and Toontown, it's definitely one to seek out, with the caveat that you should take care around the fishbowl. And here are three really quick bits of trivia for the game. The first is, there's an Easter egg. If you type the word burger in at any point, B-U-R-G-E-R, something interesting will happen. But be sure to save your game first. The second is, the word TAS comes from the fact that, according to Moby Games, the authors of this game used to teach creative writing at Harvard, where the motto is Veritas, or truth. They took to saying veritas to mean very true, extremely true, and their students just picked up the word TAS and started applying it as something that means hip or cool. And so that's where TAS times in Toontown comes from. And finally, in the online comic Homestar Runner, the character Strongbad has a floppy disk container in which you can often see labels on the disks for obscure and classic 80s games. And at one point it says TAS times in Toontown. So if it's good enough for Strongbad, it's good enough for me. And if you think it's good enough for you, then I will make the disc images available for both the regular Apple II version and the Apple II GS version, along with the supplemental material and I guess maybe the full-length version of the theme songs for both of them. Since I recorded them anyway, I might as well upload them. So if you want to play the game, you'll find the disc images there to pop into whatever is your favorite Apple II emulator. And I think that just about wraps it up for this first podcast. All my notes are gone, so that must be it. If you're listening to this, then it means I must have gone ahead with the project and uploaded the episode. And that means I would welcome your feedback, and even more so, your suggestions on what else I might include in an Apple II podcast to make it more interesting for you. I plan to do some interviews, a visit to a long-standing and, as far as I know, still existing local Apple II user group, a road trip or two to a couple of vintage computer shows, and I have a bone stock early model Apple II that I'd like to add an expansion card to each month and discuss the differences that that makes. You know, all sorts of fun stuff. And hopefully you'll join me in this little Apple II adventure. I'll see you next month. You've been listening to 1 Megahertz, the Apple II podcast. Feedback and suggestions can be sent by email to feedback@monsterfeet.com. All the files and links mentioned in this episode can be found in the show notes in the 1 Megahertz section of the monsterfeet.com website. And like all Monsterfeet podcasts, all the original material in this episode is released to the public domain.